大家好，这里是北京外语广播正在播出的大学生英语在线 Question of the Day， 我是 Michelle 米歇尔。今天我们的嘉宾是壮壮老师，今天我们要分享的话题是关于死亡。
对了，那么这个最近考试的这个话题里呢，其中就涉及到Do you agree or disagree that sometimes it is necessary to tell a lie？就是说谎到底应不应该呢？那我们今天分享的第一段呢，会讲到这个关于死亡，就是人们自我安慰的四个故事。那其实呢，这个其中就有一些个论据大家可以用，咱们先听一遍。
Who here remembers when they first realized they were going to die? I do. I was a young boy and my grandfather had just died. And I rememberA few days later, lying in bed at night, trying to make sense of what had happened. What did it mean that he was dead? Where had he gone? It was like a hole in reality had opened up and swallowed him. But then the really shocking question occurred to me, if he could die, could it happen to me too? Could that hole in reality open up and swallow me? Would it open up beneath my bed and swallow me as I slept?Well, at some point, all children become aware of death. It can happen in different ways, of course, and usually comes in stages. Our idea of death develops as we grow older. And if you reach back into the dark corners of your memory, you might remember something like what I felt when my grandfather died, and when I realized it could happen to me too. That sense that behind all of this, the void is waiting.And this development in childhood reflects the development of our species. Just as there was a point in your development as a child when your sense of self and of time became sophisticated enough for you to realize you were mortal. So at some point in the evolution of our species, some early humans' sense of self and of time became sophisticated enough for them to become the first human to realize,I'm going to die. This is, if you like, our curse. It's the price we pay for being so damn clever. We have to live in the knowledge that the worst thing that can possibly happen one day surely will. The end of all our projects, our hopes, our dreams, of our individual world. We each live in the shadow of a personal apocalypse.And that's frightening. It's terrifying. And so we look for a way out. And in my case, as I was about 5 years old, this meant asking my mum. Now, when I first started asking what happens when we die, the grown-ups around me at the time answered with a typical English mix of awkwardness and half-hearted Christianity. And the phrase I heard most often was that Grandad was now up there looking down on us.And if I should die too, which wouldn't happen, of course, then I too would go up there. Which made death sound a lot like an existential elevator. Now, this didn't sound very plausible. I used to watch a children's news program at the time, and this was the era of space exploration. There were always rockets going up into the sky, up into space, going up there. But none of the astronauts, when they came back, ever mentioned having met my granddad.Or any other dead people. But I was scared. And the idea of taking the existential elevator to see my granddad sounded a lot better than being swallowed by the void while I slept. And so I believed it anyway, even though it didn't make much sense. And this thought process that I went through as a child, and have been through many times since, including as a grown-up, is the product of what psychologists call a bias. Now, a bias...is a way in which we systematically get things wrong. Ways in which we miscalculate, misjudge, distort reality, or see what we want to see. And the bias I'm talking about works like this. Confront someone with the fact that they are going to die, and they will believe just about any story that tells them it isn't true, and they can instead live forever. Even if it means taking the existential elevator. Now,We can see this as the biggest bias of all. It has been demonstrated in over 400 empirical studies. Now, these studies are ingenious, but they're simple. They work like this. You take two groups of people, who are similar in all relevant respects, and you remind one group that they're going to die, but not the other. Then you compare their behavior. So you're observing how it biases behavior when people become aware of their mortality. And every time you get the same result. People who are made aware of their mortality are more willing to believe stories that tell them they can escape death and live forever. So here's an example. One recent study took two groups of agnostics. That is, people who are undecided in their religious beliefs. Now, one group was asked to think about being dead. The other group was asked to think about being lonely. They were then again asked about their religious beliefs. Those who had been asked to think about being dead were afterwards twice as likely to express faith in God and Jesus. Twice as likely. Even though before they were all equally agnostic. But put the fear of death in them and they run to Jesus. Now, this shows that reminding people of death biases them to believe, regardless of the evidence. And it works not just for religion, but for any kind of belief system that promises immortality in some form, whether it's becoming famous or having children or even nationalism, which promises you can live on as part of a greater whole. This is a bias that has shaped the course of human history. Now, the theory behind this bias in the over 400 studies is called terror management theory. And the idea is simple. It's just this. We develop our world views. That is, the stories we tell ourselves about the world and our place in it, in order to help us manage the terror of death. And these immortality stories have thousands of different manifestations. But I believe that behind the apparent diversity, there are actually just four basic forms that these immortality stories can take. And we can see them repeating themselves throughout history, just with slight variations to reflect the vocabulary of the day. Now, I'm going to briefly introduce these four basic forms of immortality story, and I want to try to give you some sense of the way in which they're retold by each culture or generation using the vocabulary of their day. Now, the first story is the simplest. We want to avoid death. And the dream of doing that in this body, in this world, forever, is the first and simplest kind of immortality story. And it might at first sound implausible, but actually almost every culture in human history has had some myth or legend of an elixir of life or a fountain of youth or something that promises to keep us going forever. Ancient Egypt had such myths, ancient Babylon, ancient India. Throughout European history, we find them in the work of the alchemists. And of course, we still believe this today. Only we tell this story using the vocabulary of science. So 100 years ago, hormones had just been discovered. And people hoped that hormone treatments were going to cure aging and disease. And now instead, we set our hopes on stem cells, genetic engineering and nanotechnology. But the idea that science can cure death is just one more chapter in the story of the magical elixir, a story that is as old as civilization. But betting everything on the idea of finding the elixir and staying alive forever is a risky strategy. When we look back through history at all those who have sought an elixir in the past, the one thing they now have in common is that they're all dead. So we need a backup plan. And exactly this kind of plan B is what the second kind of immortality story offers. And that's resurrection. And it stays with the idea that I am this body, I am this physical organism. It accepts that I'm going to have to die, but says, despite that, I can rise up and I can live again. In other words, I can do what Jesus did. Jesus died, he was 3 days in the tomb, then he rose up and lived again. And the idea that we can all be resurrected to live again is orthodox belief, not just for Christians, but also Jews and Muslims. But our desire to believe this story is so deeply embedded that we are reinventing it again for the scientific age. For example, with the idea of cryonics. That's the idea that when you die, you can have yourself frozen. And then at some point, when technology is advanced enough, you can be thawed out and repaired and revived and so resurrected. So some people believe an omnipotent God will resurrect them to live again, and other people believe an omnipotent scientist will do it. But for others, the whole idea of resurrection, of climbing out of the grave, is just too much like a bad zombie movie. They find the body too messy, too unreliable to guarantee eternal life. And so they set their hopes on the third, more spiritual immortality story, the idea that we can leave our body behind and live on as a soul. Now, the majority of people on earth believe they have a soul, and the idea is central to many religions. But even though in its current form, in its traditional form, the idea of the soul is still hugely popular, nonetheless, we are again reinventing it for the digital age. For example, with the idea that you can leave your body behind by uploading your mind, your essence, the real you, onto a computer, and so live on as an avatar in the ether. But of course, there are skeptics who say if we look at the evidence of science, particularly neuroscience, it suggests that your mind, your essence, the real you, is very much dependent on a particular part of your body, that is your brain. And such skeptics can find comfort in the fourth kind of immortality story, and that is legacy. The idea that you can live on through the echo you leave in the world, like the great Greek warrior Achilles, who sacrificed his life fighting at Troy so that he might win immortal fame. And the pursuit of fame is as widespread and popular now as it ever was. And in our digital age, it's even easier to achieve. You don't need to be a great warrior like Achilles or a great king or hero. All you need is an internet connection and a funny cat. But some people prefer to leave a more tangible, biological legacy. Children, for example. Or they hope to live on as part of some greater whole, a nation or a family or a tribe, or their gene pool. But again, there are skeptics who doubt whether legacy really is immortality. Woody Allen, for example, who said, "I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment." So those are the four basic kinds of immortality stories, and I've tried to give just some sense of how they're retold by each generation, with just slight variations to fit the fashions of the day. And the fact that they recur in this way, in such a similar form but in such different belief systems, suggests, I think, that we should be skeptical of the truth of any particular version of these stories. The fact that some people believe an omnipotent God will resurrect them to live again, and others believe an omnipotent scientist will do it, suggests that neither are really believing this on the strength of the evidence. Rather, we believe these stories because we are biased to believe them, and we are biased to believe them because we are so afraid of death. So the question is, are we doomed to lead the one lives we have in a way that is shaped by fear and denial? Or can we overcome this bias? Well, the Greek philosopher Epicurus thought we could. He argued that the fear of death is natural, but it is not rational. Death, he said, is nothing to us, because when we are here, death is not. And when death is here, we are gone. Now, this is often quoted, but it's difficult to really grasp, to really internalize, because exactly this idea of being gone is so difficult to imagine. So 2,000 years later, another philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, put it like this. Death is not an event in life. We do not live to experience death. And so, he added, in this sense, life has no end. So it was natural for me as a child to fear being swallowed by the void, but it wasn't rational, because being swallowed by the void is not something that any of us will ever live to experience. Now, overcoming this bias is not easy, because the fear of death is so deeply embedded in us. Yet when we see that the fear itself is not rational, and when we bring out into the open the ways in which it can unconsciously bias us, then we can at least start to try to minimize the influence it has on our lives. Now, I find it helps to see life as being like a book. Just as a book is bounded by its covers, by beginning and end, so our lives are bounded by birth and death. And even though a book is limited by beginning and end, it can encompass distant landscapes, exotic figures, fantastic adventures. And even though a book is limited by beginning and end, the characters within it know no horizons. They only know the moments that make up their story, even when the book is closed. And so the characters of a book are not afraid of reaching the last page. Long John Silver is not afraid of you finishing your copy of Treasure Island. And so it should be with us. Imagine the book of your life. Its covers, its beginning and end, are your birth and your death. You can only know the moments in between, the moments that make up your life. It makes no sense for you to fear what is outside of those covers, whether before your birth or after your death. And you needn't worry how long the book is, or whether it's a comic strip or an epic. The only thing that matters is that you make it a good story. Thank you.
好的，
好，下面这一段呢还是关于死亡，他讲的是一个医生，这个医生主要就是和濒死的人打交道，然后人家就会问他 Am I going to die? 然后呢他是到底是说好呢还是不说好，那么他有一些具体的案例分析，所以这个也可以给你这个在说谎这件事儿是不是应该的这个话题中呢提供一些素材，我们来听。
好的。
I've been a critical care EMT for the past 7 years in Suffolk County, New York.I've been a first responder in a number of incidents ranging from car accidents to Hurricane Sandy. If you're like most people, death might be one of your greatest fears. Some of us will see it coming. Some of us won't. There's a little known documented medical term called impending doom. It's almost a symptom. As a medical provider, I'm trained to respond to the symptom like any other. So when a patient having a heart attack looks at me and says, I'm going to die today, we are trained to reevaluate the patient's condition.Throughout my career, I've responded to a number of incidents where a patient had minutes left to live, and there was nothing I could do for them. With this, I was faced with a dilemma. Do I tell the dying that they are about to face death, or do I lie to them to comfort them? Early in my career, I faced this dilemma by simply lying. I was afraid. I was afraid if I told them the truth, that they would die in terror and fear,just grasping for those last moments of life. That all changed with one incident. 5 years ago, I responded to a motorcycle accident. The rider had suffered critical injuries. As I assessed him, I realized that there was nothing that could be done for him. And like so many other cases, he looked me in the eye and asked that question, am I going to die? In that moment, I decided to do something different. I decided to tell him the truth.I decided to tell him that he was going to die and that there was nothing I could do for him. His reaction shocked me to this day. He simply laid back and had a look of acceptance on his face. He was not met with that terror or fear that I thought he would be. He simply laid there, and as I looked into his eyes, I saw inner peace and acceptance. From that moment forward, I decided it was not my place to comfort the dying with my lies.Having responded to many cases since then where patients were in their last moments and there was nothing I could do for them, in almost every case, they have all had the same reaction to the truth of inner peace and acceptance. In fact, there are three patterns I have observed in all these cases. The first pattern always kind of shocked me. Regardless of religious belief or cultural background, there's a need for forgiveness.Whether they call it sin, or they simply say they have a regret, their guilt is universal. I had once cared for an elderly gentleman who was having a massive heart attack. As I prepared myself and my equipment for his imminent cardiac arrest, I began to tell the patient of his intimate demise. He already knew by my tone of voice and body language. As I placed the defibrillator pads on his chest, prepping for what was going to happen, he looked me in the eye and said,I wish I had spent more time with my children and grandchildren instead of being selfish with my time. Faced with imminent death, all he wanted was forgiveness. A second pattern I observed is the need for remembrance. Whether it was to be remembered in my thoughts or their loved ones, they needed to feel that they would be living on. There's a need for immortality within the hearts and thoughts of their loved ones, myself, my crew, or anyone around.Countless times, I have had a patient look me in the eyes and say, will you remember me? The final pattern I observed always touched me the deepest, to the soul. The dying need to know that their life had meaning. They need to know that they did not waste their life on meaningless tasks. This came to me very, very early in my career. I responded to a call. There was a female in her late 50s, severely pinned within a vehicle. She had been T-boned at a high rate of speed. Critical condition. As the fire department worked to remove her from the car, I climbed in to begin to render care. As we talked, she had said to me, there was so much more I wanted to do with my life. She had felt she had not left her mark on this earth. As we talked further, it would turn out that she was a mother of two adopted children who were both on their way to medical school. Because of her, two children had a chance they never would have had otherwise and would go on to save lives in the medical field as medical doctors. It would end up taking 45 minutes to free her from the vehicle. However, she perished prior to freeing her. I believed what you saw in the movies. You're in those last moments that it's strictly terror, fear. I've come to realize, regardless of the circumstance, it's generally met with peace and acceptance. That is, the littlest things, the littlest moments, the littlest things you brought into the world that gives you peace in those final moments. Thank you.
其实就这个医生和这个病人哈，我就觉得这也是一种心理上的考验。当然我们今天分享这俩，大家在生活当中有医生病人，这个可能不会遇到完全类似的场景，但是就是平常生活当中呢
肯定会有。
但是就像医生病人这种，我觉得这种
很微妙，
非常微妙。
对，而且这个医生嘛，大家刚才听的时候你发现了没有，他一开始呢他是特别不忍心告诉病人真情、
嗯、
他会藏着掖着是吧，然后呢他有一次他就是偶然他就发现了这个人很理智，这个病人，然后呢他就是明确的告诉他说 We have done all we can、and you are going to die。 但这时候出乎他意料的时候，就是这个病人呢并没有说立刻被恐慌所击倒，相反、他就是 show inner peace and acceptance， 接受了这个现实。而且他分了几大类，就是通常情况下人们在知道自己即将去世的时候会有哪些想法。而且其中一点我觉得我自己很受震撼的，他就说呢，说的大多数人会想啊，首先是比如说饶恕他人，得到宽恕。最多的一个 pattern， 这个规律就是说他会想自己是不是给人类社会留下了些印记，留下的是什么印记？对，甭管他的职业是多么的卑微，做的事情多么的普通，哎，这一点我觉得挺让我吃惊的。
嗯
嗯，所以今天呢，这个给大家介绍的两段关于死亡的，我希望大家在之后呢再去听，因为死亡这个大多数人写作文或者是口语基本上不会谈到。
哇，我也觉得嘛，我考了这么多次都没有遇到过。
哎，但是你说这个题目呢，他会问你，比如说我们到底应不应该撒谎？
嗯、
那这个关于生死的时候，往往是医生也好，还有护士也好，他都会很纠结这个问题。
嗯、
好，那希望大家听完了之后有所启发。
是的，我们明天见。
The other people watching me, and we're all people watching the other people watching we, and we're as lonely as we wanted to be. We're all as lonely as we wanted to be, just as lonely as we wanted to be. I'm just you, you're just me. It's only true.Nobody never told me not to do. So I'll keep people watching, watching me now.
下一期大学生英语在线将继续为您带来 TED Talk 的内容。
接下来您将听到的是私房拷贝。Coming up next is home video.
so